Kim.
What?
Na.
By us.
Acharitam. Performed.
Shreya.
Pious work.
Na Veda.
Do not know.
Aham.
I. Adishvara. O Supreme Controller.
Yoga.
Of mystic yoga.
Ishvaranam.
By the masters.
Durdasha.
Really seen.
Yat.
That.
Naha.
By us.
Drishtaha.
Seen.
Kumedasam.
Who are unintelligent. Translation. King Yudhisthira said, O Supreme Controller, I do not know what pious deeds we fools have done so that we can see you, whom the masters of yogic perfection really see. Text 12. Requested by the king to stay with them, the Almighty Lord remained happily in Indraprastha during the months of the raining season, giving joy to the eyes of the city's residents. Purport. If possible, the readers of Bhagavatam should try to correctly chant the Sanskrit verses, which are exquisitely poetic.
Om Gyanatmanandasya Gnanjana Shilakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Guru Namaha. Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasari Gaurav Vrinda. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram Ram
Hare Hare. So, as devotees, we are concerned with the pursuit of the ultimate. What is the final destination of life? Sometimes when people were speaking to Srila Prabhupada, he would cut right to the point, cut to the chase. What is the ultimate goal of life? And if you ask many people that question, you often find that people get very defensive. It's just too probing. It cuts to the heart of the matter too directly. You see, in the material world, especially in our contemporary situation, where sense gratification is so available, and people live very hedonistic lives, distractionary lives, to address ultimate issues is a little bit confronting. Because generally, in our day-to-day lives, we're just focused on, you know, one sense gratificatory experience, then the next, then the next. You know, people are studying, then going to parties on the weekend. They're thinking, after I finish studying, then I'll get some work, I might go traveling a bit. Maybe do a little bit of yoga here and there, and, you know, add in some spiritual spice to add flavor to the whole thing. And in this way, I'll pass my time. It's a rather reactionary way of living, that life will throw up various challenges and circumstances, and I'll simply respond and try to remain entertained as life rolls on. So this is, of course, symptomatic of a society or a civilization focused on economic development and sense gratification. And it's a civilization that is put, is considered religion and spirituality no longer applicable. Of course, the religion of the day is contemporary science. And the doctrine of contemporary science, although it has not been proven, is that life is simply a chance occurrence arising from a combination of chemicals. Your sense of self is nothing but a spasm in the void. It's just your neurons doing something. that gives you a sense of consciousness and self-identity. This is the religion of the day. This is the belief system of the day. And naturally, you know, as Claude Monard said, I think it's a quote in Searching for Vedic India. He said, "Now the ancient covenant is in pieces. Man at last knows for certain that he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the cosmos, in which he has arisen just by chance. Neither his destiny or his duty has been written down." So basically we're animals in the indifferent, vast and indifferent, impersonal cosmos. This is the thesis. This is the presentation of the, you know, the mainstream modern thinkers. And whether the individual members of society embrace this consciously, from a very young age they're indoctrinated to believe it, at least subconsciously. And what that does is leave the human being with no purpose, with no ultimate purpose. His destiny or his duty has not been written down. There is no higher power, there is no moral code that descends from the lawmaker, the supreme lawmaker. There is no such thing. It's just it's just whatever you want it to be. Make the most of it, because when you die, you die, and that's it. It's all black. It's finished. So, you know, unconsciously or consciously, people have this conception, and therefore life becomes a matter of titillation, of distractionary pursuits. I like this quote from Nirvana, the band Nirvana. "Here we are now, entertain us." And anybody who's familiar with that band, kind of was in my era when I was growing up as a teenager. I'd never listened to them that much, but I was aware that they were around. They were a very melancholy type of band. And the lead singer eventually committed suicide or overdosed. So it kind of has a melancholy ring to it. Here we are now. There is no purpose, but here we are. Entertain us. Keep us at least distracted from our sufferings and from facing ourselves, at least while we're here. So, yeah, this question, what is the ultimate goal of life? What is the function of your existence? Is very confronting. Most people find it very rude that you should, you know, confront them so intensely with such an intense question. What is the ultimate goal of life? And then they kind of shift uncomfortably, get defensive, and anyway, you know, and they get caught up with the details of the day-to-day existence. But as devotees, as seekers of the truth, that's ultimately what a devotee should be, is a seeker of the truth. To become Krishna conscious means to pursue the absolute truth. What is really real, and how to live in relationship with that ultimate reality. So a devotee should be concerned with this ultimate truth. And that's what the Vedic Shastra deals with. That's the wonderful thing about it, is that it cuts to the heart of the matter. The first verse in Vedanta Sutra is Janmadi Yasya Taha. It's the same as Bhagavatam, actually. That the Supreme Absolute Truth is that source of everything, is that from which everything has come from. So it sets the tone right from the beginning. We're dealing with ultimate issues here. And then proceeds to explain, you know, different levels of understanding of that absolute. And here in this verse, King Yudhisthira is explaining that Krishna, in fact, the yogis, by their practice, are pursuing that absolute truth. Still, they really see the personality of Godhead directly. You see, in the Vedic blueprint for human civilization, it's understood that there's different activities of human life. Dharma, that one should perform his activities in relationship to the nature of things in a harmonious way, according to the laws given along with the cosmos. One should perform dharma. Artha, then one has a right to perform economic development, the harvest of the resources of the world, in order for karma, sense gratification. But then moksha. Ultimately, moksha should be there. What is moksha? Liberation. That one should come to that point of perceiving the material energy, perceiving the fault in the material world so clearly that he decides, okay, this is a waste of time, this is just simply going round and round in circles, there's no conclusion here, there's no satisfaction here, therefore let me pursue liberation from my conditioned existence. And moksha, for the attainment of moksha, there is the yoga system. And the yoga system has many different styles, many different methodologies and philosophies, but the goal is one. The goal is connecting one's consciousness with the absolute truth, creating a link. Because at every moment we're connecting with something. If you're cutting your toenails, you're connecting with the toenail clipper, you're connecting with your toenails. Because that is what is within your consciousness. That's what you're meditating on. If you're cooking dinner, that's what you're meditating on. If you're in love, you're meditating on the form of your object of love. So at every moment, our consciousness is connecting with something. And that may or may not be an ultimate reality. In fact, it could be a complete illusion that we've concocted out of our own mind. But we're connected with that. Because, what does it mean? Because it's within our consciousness. It's what we're aware of. So, for the yogi, the goal is to have a connection with the absolute truth. So what is within the consciousness is that absolute truth. Seeing things as they are, but also connecting with that supreme person. Because if we make an analysis, the highest thing in life is relationships with other people. That is where the rasa, the taste, the flavor comes, and the satisfaction comes through relationships. So, by a logical deduction, you can understand that if a person is the most dynamic phenomenon of this world, and everything's come from the absolute truth, then that absolute truth must also contain personhood. And if the highest experience we can have is relational, and the flavors arising from relationships, then the highest connection with that absolute truth must be relational. So this is the wonderful knowledge that we have coming to us through Srimad Bhagavatam, through what Prabhupada has given us. Here King Yudhisthira is saying, O Supreme Controller, I do not know what pious deeds we fools have done, so that we can see you, who the masters of yogic perfection really see. So King Yudhisthira is aware that he is in contact with Bhagavan. Supreme Controller. That will that is supreme. And he is saying, you know, I don't know what we've done. Now the question is, by our actions, is it actually possible to get revelation of the absolute truth? If you align everything up properly, you tune everything, you know, you do your yoga postures perfectly, you align your chakras, you do your breathing exercises properly, you intone your mantras with perfect, perfect finesse. You purify your body in such a way, you think in a very dynamic, analytical way. Is it possible that you can get revelation of the Absolute Truth? Then you then grab the Absolute Truth, contain Him within your mind, and contemplate it. Is it possible? By being a good person? Huh? By performing good karma? Is it possible? Well, the Christian says, not by works. That you cannot. By your endeavor, by manipulating your body-mind apparatus, and by performing certain activities in the material energy, you're not going to necessarily, gain insight into the nature of the Absolute Truth. No, that's actually, that depends on Krishna. That depends on the Absolute Truth. Whether the Absolute Truth will reveal Himself to you, because the Absolute Truth is superior to you. Therefore, you cannot force the Absolute Truth to do anything. You cannot force Krishna to do anything. So, in bhakti, what we are doing is simply demonstrating our sincerity, that we want to know the Absolute Truth, we want to love the Absolute Truth. All the activities of Krishna consciousness are simply for this purpose, to display devotion. And in one sense, that is our reward as well, because by tasting our devotion to the Absolute Truth, we become satisfied. And when Krishna sees that the devotee is consistent and sincere and trustworthy, honest in heart, then He will reveal Himself to the devotee. In a certain way as well, because that's not the same for every devotee. Krishna is so vast, so unlimited, so inconceivable, that it's impossible for one jiva soul to have a complete picture or a complete experience of the Absolute Truth. No, it's simply we have a certain relationship. And by our bhakti, that relationship will become more pronounced, more revealed. And here Yudhisthira is saying, what pious deeds? So actually what he's saying is actually it's impossible simply by pious deeds to understand you. Therefore, what is the conclusion? It must be your mercy. It must be your mercy. Otherwise it's not possible. And then he says, what deeds have we fools? Now was Yudhisthira a fool? What do we think? Put it this way. If Yudhisthira was a fool, what are we? No, Yudhisthira is an extraordinary personality. King of the world in the Vedic age. Eternal associate of the Lord. He's supremely intelligent, actually. Son of Dhammaraj. Now, Yudhisthira is not unintelligent. Yudhisthira, managing the whole world is no small task. Now, there are many computer nerds around who can, engineer software and understand the intricacies of binary, but they just can't function when it comes to people. To deal with people actually takes a lot of intelligence, not just you know, intelligence with things, but intelligence with emotions, with the feeling, what is the motivation of the person, where are they coming from, what is their internal experience. Many factors, many, many factors to take into consideration when leading and managing people, and Yudhisthira was leading the whole world. Very intelligent. In his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Dale Carnegie talks about, you know, the people who can lead people or deal with people effectively, they're the highest paid. They're the highest paid because they know how to, you know, if you can inspire people, then the people can get the things done. If you keep the people happy and inspired and enthused, then the people get the things done. So that's actually, that's a real qualification. So Yudhisthira had that. Obviously, people loved Yudhisthira. And they respected him deeply because Yudhisthira was kind of haunted, actually. What was his obsession? His obsession was Dharma. What is the correct thing to do? And he was so determined to do that, and, you know, just completely, you know, put my emotions, my lower nature, my passions, they're just, anyway, they don't even come into the picture. What is the correct thing to do? What is Dharma? What does the Veda say? What do the great sages say? And he was haunted by this. If you read Mahabharata, the whole thing, he's always calculating what is the correct thing to do. Sometimes Bhima was so furious with the Kauravas, especially when they tried to disrobe Draupadi. Bhima was so furious, he was ready to just burn them to death with his gaze, what to speak, and crush every bone in their body. Yeah. Which he's perfectly capable of doing, actually. Later, he, you know, when they were incognito, there was one army general who was trying to Kichaka, who was trying to seduce Draupadi, embed Draupadi. When Bhima found out about this, he said, "Anyway, I don't care that we're in exile. I'm going to deal with this fellow." And you know, he said to Draupadi, "You just tell him that you'll meet him tonight in this particular chamber of the palace, which they were hiding out in." So he did that. She did that. So later, this army general, Kichaka, he came in the evening, and he saw this form lying down on the bed, and he thought, "Oh," because he'd been anticipating the whole day. "Now I will enjoy this beautiful, most beautiful of women." So he came and he sort of said, "I am Kichaka." You know, just like, you know, lusty tones. He was saying, "Yes, I am a great general," and this and that, praising himself like anything. "And now you will get to finally enjoy with Kichaka." And Bhima said, "Oh, that is very good." He sat up and he grabbed him, and a big fight ensued. But eventually, Bhima overcame Kichaka. And he shoved, once he destroyed it, once he broke his back, he shoved all his limbs inside his body. His head inside his body, his legs inside his body, his arms inside his body. And rolled him up into a little ball and just stamped on him, you know, until there's just this bloody lump of flesh. Everybody was shocked when they saw the incident in the morning. They saw the evidence. Because there was a rumor around that Draupadi had 5 Gandhava husbands who would follow her around, and anyone that messed with her was destroyed by these Gandhava husbands. Anyway, so Bhima was ready to destroy the Kauravas. He was ready to destroy them right then and there. But he was restrained by his respect for his elder brother, Dhammaraj, Yudhisthira, who was sitting there pondering, what is the correct thing to do? Is Draupadi still our wife or not? Because there was a complex issue when she was one in the gambling match. Yeah. So he was just thinking about this, and he also, you know, part of, obviously, if your wife gets insulted like that, you feel upset and angry. But he, no, he wasn't going to act simply on his emotion. He wanted to know what was correct. So Yudhisthira is no fool, huh? But here he's saying, "I am unintelligent. I am a fool." So simply, that is his humility. That is his humility. And it's also, in one sense, he's saying that, no, it's not by our qualifications that we can see you now, Krishna, that you're prepared to stay with us. It is not by our qualifications. It is simply your mercy. To be proud, actually, in this material world is kind of foolish. Very foolish, actually. Because it's like, you know, going out and renting a car, and then you drive up, you know, to some, you know, say you're a guy, you rent a car, you drive up along the street and boop boop, and check out my car, girls, you know, and try and, like, you know, show off this car that you've rented. Yeah, isn't it cool? That means I'm cool as well, just by association. Yeah, it's an extended conception of the false ego. It's foolish because you don't own the car. You know, similarly, you know, who put in a little, in a form, you know, brown eyes, you know, big biceps, go bald at 30, you know, club foot, speech impediment. Who put in a form, you know, before they are born, specifying what they would like in their material body? It's one sense the luck of the draw, but no, it's actually from your past karma. But the fact is, you know, if you become very proud of your body, it's simply, you know, it's on loan, with all its strengths and with all its faults. It's on loan, it's not actually yours. It's simply a manifestation of the material energy, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. All the flesh and everything that makes up the body will simply disintegrate when you leave, along with all the qualities and the good looks and the intelligence and the brain substance, all that sort of stuff will simply rot away into the earth. So, well, it's not really yours to be proud of anyway. Krishna says in the Gita, "Strength, I am the strength of the strong." So if you have any strength, if you have any good qualities, and you're realistic, you should realize those are gifts, actually. You know, we had this term, gifted, he's gifted. What does that mean? Basically, it's not to his credit. It means it's a gift. And therefore, what? He should use it in service. Or she should use that in service. To others, and to ultimately to God, to Krishna. So Yudhisthira has this realization, obviously. He's enlightened completely. He understands what is going on. And therefore he's humble. With his humble mood, he's saying, actually, we have no qualification to see you. Simply by your mercy, you're appearing before us. And Krishna appreciates humility in his devotees. As I said, you know, to be proud is actually foolish. It means to be covered by a false ego. It means to misunderstand what's going on. Yeah, Krishna likes his devotees to be humble. To be realistic. You know, one definition of humble is, it's not to think of you less of yourself. You know, I'm so low, I'm so, you know, this, I'm so that, and I'm just lower than a woman's stool. You know, it's not necessarily to think less of yourself. No, it means to think of yourself less. In other words, you know, put the focus on your service. Yeah, Krishna likes humility in his devotees. In fact, you know, when the gopis became proud in the rasa dance, that oh, we're so fortunate. Krishna is spending time with us. He's attached to us, you know, in the rasa dance. Krishna, as soon as he detected that, he disappeared. So in one sense, when the mind is proud and puffed up, you know, Krishna does not appear there, actually. There's two types of happiness. You have happiness when you're feeling excellent about your false ego. You know, you're feeling excellent. Well, I'm such a good person. I'm pretty awesome. You know, I did all these amazing things. And you feel good about yourself. You feel kind of happy. Yeah, me. You know, but that's very fragile. Very fragile. And then there's another type of happiness. When you're connected with Krishna. And you're doing devotional service. And Krishna's pleased, and therefore you're pleased. So the illusory type of happiness, that's so fragile, because at any moment some disaster could happen and your sense of self could completely change at any moment, very suddenly, or just gradually it'll change, you know, as you get old and decrepit and start forgetting things and dribbling you know, and get weak and your hair falls out, you know, then you're false ego will get crushed and you won't feel so good about yourself. So it's fragile because it's illusory. But, you know, for the devotee who's cultivating a relationship with Krishna, that happiness is always accessible in any stage of life, in any state of being, heaven or hell, young or old, because it's eternal. But to be in that state of consciousness, one has to be humble. Or realistic, actually. Understand. If you're realistic, then you'll be humble. Once I was going through a particularly introspective phase of my Krishna consciousness, and I was thinking about, you know, really looking at myself and realize, oh God, so many anartas here. You know, and I hadn't really integrated and assimilated that into who I was and things like that. So I was struggling with that a bit. And I wrote my Gurudev one letter, you know, saying, I feel weak and this and that. And he wrote back saying, yes, everybody is weak before Krishna. They'll simply become absorbed in devotional service to his lotus feet. Everybody is weak before Krishna. That's the fact. If you think you're strong, it's very relative. It's nothing to be proud of. It's not even your strength. So Krishna appreciates that in his devotees. And humility is, you know, naturally, if somebody is very puffed up, you know, sitting there, you know, me, you know that you kind of like, you kind of go like, well, I don't want to give this person any more fuel for their false ego. And you notice within yourself, you kind of just hold back and you just kind of like, anyway. That's a psychological principle. That it's a tall poppy syndrome is another. That somebody is very puffed up, or very full of themselves, we tend to try and cut them down. Because it's just kind of distasteful. A lot of pride. So, and what it does in the society of devotees is it cuts off the flow of mercy into your life, being proud. Prabhupada says in the preface to Nectar of Instruction that advancement in devotional service depends on the attitude of the follower. So pretty much that's it. If you get your attitude right, that's the perfection. Because we're not the doers and we cannot... you know, we cannot control the outcome of our activities. Our responsibility begins and ends with what is our attitude. So when our attitude is right, our conception is right, we're situated correctly, then the flow of mercy into our life is there. It's unimpeded. As soon as you get proud and start thinking, I'm the doer, I am this, I'm that, I'm the big man, I'm the big woman, then the reign of mercy stops. And you start struggling on your own strength. And eventually, you get smashed. Yeah, eventually you get smashed. Because it's an illusion. Yeah? Reality will check in at some stage. So, yeah, very nice prayer by Yudhisthira. O Supreme Controller, I do not know what pious deeds we fools have done that we can see it, whom the masters of mystic yoga, who the masters of yoga perfection really see. He's grateful. And this sight, if any display of gratitude increases the desire of the giver to continue to give. So gratitude, humility, appreciation, these are all important emotions to feel in spiritual life. Spiritual life is not simply an intellectual process. There is emotions on the spiritual platform. Those emotions just need to be expressed in relation to the absolute truth, not in relationship to some transient manifestations of the material substance. And then the emotion that you are a person eternally. So Krishna consciousness addresses that reality and allows you to be a person completely. So I'll stop there. Is there any questions or comments on these points? Yes, Prabhu.
One comment about the inspiration. I was thinking, when you were telling about Yudhishthira Maharaj, I was thinking of Srila Prabhupada. How much inspired one volume of Chaitanya Charitamrita every day they were producing.
He inspired them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great inspiration. Almost an impossible task. One volume a day.
People want, because the nature of the spirit soul is service, you know, people actually want to give themselves to some cause that is bigger than themselves. And often what that takes is a leader, an inspired leader, somebody who is so inspired by some cause, by their service, that it infects those who come in contact with that person. And due to his his relationship that he builds with his followers, and the example that he has, and just the qualities of his of the personality, people want to give to that mission as well. They want to serve and assist. That's very important. Leadership is very essential. And leadership always means a person. There's no such thing.
As you said, Srila Prabhupada was so fixed and determined in the service of Mahaprabhu.
Yeah.
He will do anything.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, he captured the heart of so many. You know, we see, like, last night I was meditating on my Gurudev and, you know, how dedicated he is and determined. And I was thinking, he was inspired by Srila Prabhupada. Not a foolish person. So it's important, the quality of leaders is very important. Leadership is always personal as well. And if you ever, you know, every devotee can be a leader as well, simply by their personal example, their enthusiasm. King Yudhisthira is such a leader. That's why, you know, everybody wanted him. You know, after the Kurukshetra war, he was reluctant. He actually didn't want to take the throne. He thought, I am so sinful because this war has taken place because of me. Huh? To put me on the throne, this war has taken place. So many women and children now they've lost their fathers and their husbands. This is a big problem. And it's all caused by me. I cannot I might as well burn in hell for billions of lifetimes. I cannot be purified by any act of atonement. Just as much as a wine-stained pot cannot be purified by water. You know, the wine has stained the pot and soaked in and actually discolored the clay. You can't just clean that with water and detergent. And he said, I cannot be purified from all this sin. He didn't want to take, but everybody was pushing him. You just did. Get on the throne, man. you're qualified for this. You know, everybody, we're all behind you. That's why we fought this war, you know, to get you on the throne, because of your wonderful qualities, because of your allegiance to Dharma. We have full faith. And it took Bhishma eventually convinced him. Even Krishna, as my Gurudev was explaining yesterday in a lecture. Yeah. You know, the Kauravas, they were doing an okay job managing the kingdom. Why did they get destroyed in the war? Because Krishna didn't like them. That was the problem, you know. Krishna didn't like them. Yeah. I don't want you guys. I want these guys, you know. So the whole situation took place because Krishna didn't like them. Why? Because the attitude was bad, you know. They had a bad attitude. I don't like these guys. Get them out of there. Put you just doing it. The quality of the leadership attracts certain followers as well. Any other points? Still pretty early, so we better make some points. At least for 5 or 10 more minutes. Would you like to say anything, Aniruddha Prabhu? What are the symptoms of a service attitude? One is humility, of course. That one should be humble and respectful. Because one is you know, by the nature of service, one is giving to others. So implicit in that has to be respect for others and those you're serving. And humility needs to be there as well. If one is very puffed up, then they're simply serving their false ego. And also eagerness. I think eagerness naturally comes when one is serving a worthwhile cause or worthwhile leader. There will naturally be eagerness and enthusiasm. I was thinking, you know, I've never been really tired or bored since I've been a devotee. You know, physically you get tired, but the mental enthusiasm doesn't really go away, you know. Simply you work, you're doing service, you're doing service, you're doing service until you run out of energy and then you have to sleep and then you get up and do more service. But never really feel like that the service is a burden. Whereas if you're working in a mundane job, in the mundane world, it's just like watching the clock, when's that flaming hand going to go round 8 times so I can go home, you know, and do what I really want to do. No, it's not like that. Devotional service, because the cause and nature, the heart is into it, and the intelligence is fired up to figure out how to constantly improve the service. One doesn't get fatigued in terms of one's motivation. So I think that eagerness is there as well. Do you have something specific in mind you're thinking? Yeah, I think respectfulness, humbleness, and eagerness are very important in it. In a gratifying service attitude. You know, if any leader who sees that humility, respectfulness, and same time eagerness, especially when combined with competence, any leader is very happy. They're thinking, this is wonderful. Huh? and they'll try to offer all facility to such a person. If they're willing and able and their attitude is correct, then we should. We should facilitate such a eager servant.
What about unconditional?
Unconditional.
Unconditional.
No expectation of return. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's actually the definition of service.
Otherwise, you just do business deal, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, otherwise it's an exchange. That's a very good point. Unconditional. Yeah, that's the definition of service, is that you're doing it as a service without expectation of return. Pure charity.
Haitiki.
Unmotivated. Any last points? Okay, thank you very much. We'll finish here. Gontaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki.
Yeah.